Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Leanna Byrne and thanks for tuning in to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, Big Tech under fire as a Kenyan court lets fired Facebook moderators take Meta to trial over union claims and working conditions.
You're keeping them in this torture chamber where throughout they're exposed to harmful contents.
That's the end of a long week for Boeing as the airplane maker loses millions because its workers are on strike. How long can it hold out? And the price of gold hits fresh highs. We'll find out why. But first, we begin with the rising crisis in the Middle East, where worries are increasing about a potential all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah, a militant and political group based in Lebanon, which is backed by Iran, Israel's main rival. In the past few days, we've seen some of the heaviest cross-border attacks since the conflict in Gaza began nearly a year ago. With all this uncertainty, how are businesses in Lebanon managing to survive? Aline Karnakian is the owner of the Mayrig restaurant in Beirut. We spoke to her on the programme a few weeks ago, and I caught up with her earlier to hear how things are developing there.
Today we were hit in Beirut. Okay, it is very near. We heard it very well. Every day we're having a sound barrier, which play with your nerves and depress you. And you are afraid, you don't want to do something else. The situation is definitely much worse than it was. And it's getting worse than worse. Not everyone has the security to go out. You don't know where and how what will be exploded. Plus, financially, you don't know tomorrow will be. So you need to take care of your finance. You need to take care of your family.
How are you managing in these conditions?
We're not yet firing people. We do not want to fire our team. If you fire someone, he or she will not find a job. To stay humane, to stay business, which one to go, how to decide, this is really unknown.
We've also heard about panic buying and the potential collapse of basic infrastructure in Lebanon. I mean, how's your restaurant preparing for possible shortages of food, maybe even fuel, other essentials? How do you prepare for that in the coming weeks?
Kind of, we are used to this. We do have reserves, but these reserves are for short term. Fuel, you cannot store it for 3 months, 4 months. You can store it for a week, 10 days, 15 days, not more.
You are still in business, though, but if things continue to deteriorate, what do you think the future holds for businesses like yours in Lebanon?
We're going to close. You cannot sustain. You cannot. It's impossible to sustain unless you're doing something illegal or something. But if you are honest businessman and working on to sustain some clientele, don't forget that your clientele also, it's a circle, you know. Someone will do a business to come and spend it to your restaurant. Everything is on hold. You cannot predict, you cannot forecast. How do you want to know? You cannot. There's no such thing, and it's nobody knows where we're going.
Yeah. In your last conversation with my colleague Ed Butler, you said you were very much committed to staying in Beirut despite the challenges. After this latest attack, has your view changed at all?
Look, I'm Lebanese. I still say I'd rather stay here. I'd rather not to leave. I would do anything. I will stay until my last drop. But again, where are we going and how long and how much? And how much I can sustain, whether I want it or not. There is limit what I can do. I do not wish to go. I want to stay here. I want to do my business here. I want to stay with my family and my friends. We're paying a price of we did not choose. You know, it's not that I chose or I vote or something. Imagine I come and tell you, you're going to leave, you're going to pay the price of something that you did not choose. It's not the way of life that you want.
That was Aline Karnacki, a restaurant owner in Beirut. Now, it's important to remember that Lebanon has been struggling for years, long before the current tensions. The country faced one of the worst financial crises in history. Over the past decade, its economy has shrunk dramatically, the currency's collapsed, and prices have skyrocketed there as well. We've got Elliot Abrams. He's Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. And he joins us now. Elliot, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. As I just mentioned, Lebanon has been struggling economically, politically as well for some years. So what does the latest escalation and violence mean for the country?
It just makes it worse. As you said, the currency collapsed. I mean, it was a 98% collapse, which is amazing. As people think about, for example, potential purchases of real estate in Lebanon or investment in Lebanon, why would you do that now when there is a prospect of a major war between Israel and Hezbollah?
Mm. Now, you served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor in the administration of President George W. Bush. So you have extensive experience in U.S. policy in the Middle East. So how do ongoing conflicts like this current tension between Israel and Hezbollah impact the overall economic stability of the region?
Again, it just makes everything worse. I mean, for example, 70% decline in traffic in the Suez Canal because of the Houthi attacks. So international trade is affected. If it looks as if there's going to be an Israel-Lebanon war and Israel-Hezbollah war, and that it will bring in Iran, watch insurance rates for shipping in the Gulf and near the Gulf. It's going to just depress growth rates and investment everywhere.
Mm. But give us some context of how important Lebanon is to the Middle East broader economy, because at one point it was very important for banking, wasn't it?
It was. This is a tragic thing. I mean, if you go back, say, 25 years, it was a financial capital, but now it really isn't. I mean, it's a small country, 6 million people. It's a small GDP now. GDP collapsed about by half. So it's maybe $18 billion. That's a third of the GDP, even of Jordan. The financial stuff has moved to the Gulf, to places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Manama and Doha. So this is a problem for the Lebanese, that as the economy declines in size, it gets less attention, it becomes less significant for the region as a whole.
But how insulated are the Gulf economies?
They are not insulated from a war, that's for sure. They are insulated, I would say now, from the Lebanese economy financially. They're once upon a time, the Saudi-Lebanese financial relationship was really quite significant. It's much less significant now. And I would say the Gulf economies are pretty well insulated against the economy of troubles in the economy of Lebanon. Those troubles would probably affect places like Syria, above all, Turkey to some extent, but not the Gulf.
Okay. And what if the conflict spreads and involves Iran? Do you see key trade routes in that region being affected?
Absolutely. I mean, already, as we were saying, the Suez Canal is, the Gulf really not. But if there's a conflict that is, in a sense, flying over the Gulf, it could really affect the Gulf countries. You could imagine there are some nightmares here, insurance rates skyrocketing, oil prices skyrocketing, and Iran that thinks that Saudi Arabia or the Emirates are complicit with attacks from Israel, attacking those countries on the other side of the Gulf. Those are nightmare scenarios. But if you're an investor, if you're a trader, you're certainly going to have those at the back of your mind.
Absolutely, for sure. Elliot Abrams, we really appreciate you being on the program and thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, let's go to Kenya because a court there has ruled that Meta, that's Facebook's parent company, can be sued over the dismissal of content moderators. These workers say they were fired for trying to form a union and that they were blacklisted from new jobs when Meta changed contractors. And this ruling could impact how tech companies manage outsourced workers. Mercy Mutiyim represented the content moderators and explained the grievances that led to the case against the Facebook and Instagram owner.
The first theme of grievance is human trafficking for labor. So a lot of them were brought to Kenya from different countries, but full disclosure wasn't made on the work they were coming to Kenya to do. They weren't told they were coming to do work for Meta. And more importantly, they weren't being told the work is content moderation or it's work that could potentially harm your mental health. So some of them came to the country thinking they were coming to do call center jobs, others thinking they're coming to do mere digital jobs. So to come to the country under false pretenses and the ILO framework, that's human trafficking for labor. Then secondly, while they were doing the work, they were exposed to unreasonable working conditions where there's so much pressure on productivity and less prominence was given to mental health care. So they weren't given proper psychosocial support while doing the work, which included access to properly qualified doctors, enough time, adequate time to seek therapy. For example, they didn't have enough cover to see psychiatrists or psychologists when they developed mental health illnesses from doing the work. So there's that aspect as well. There's another theme of grievance which centers around the redundancy. When the layoffs were being carried out, they weren't carried out lawfully. So the laid out procedure on redundancy wasn't followed. Mm-hmm. And then discrimination as well. When they tried to apply for jobs, because Meta was changing partners, so they lost jobs because Meta was changing partners and then applied to the new partner and they were being discriminated against. Even if they were qualified, they were being discriminated against and weren't offered those jobs. So that's the other grievance they have, yes.
Meta has previously said it requires its contractors and those workers they were hired through a contractor, it requires its contractors to provide industry-leading conditions. It does have a reputation of being a good place to work generally. I mean, how do you respond to that?
The evidence would speak differently. The content moderators are young people who came into the work very healthy and very hopeful about them, because they were plucked at their prime. And now they're quite literally destitute. Their lives have been ruined by the work. And they've been ruined because reasonable steps weren't taken to take care of them while they were doing the work. So if you look at the experience they went through, and even if you read the case we filed in court, when you see that evidence, you begin to question whether enough audits were undertaken by Meta to find out what was really happening on the ground. And in any case, Meta was benefiting from the violation of the rights. This insistence on unreasonable productivity metrics, that's for Meta's benefit, because that means more tickets were being actioned in a day.
Now, what is the significance of the Kenyan court's decision to allow Meta to be sued in Kenya over this?
This is a huge signal from the Court of Appeal that it doesn't matter what labor arrangements a big tech company settles for, whether it's an outsourced model, whether it's for click work and platform work. As long as there have been human rights violations along the supply chain, the big tech company will be held accountable for that. That's a signal we are getting from the Court of Appeal.
Content moderation, though, is important work. How can companies, in your opinion, like Meta, balance that need for content moderation with the ethical treatment of workers who are doing it?
It's not impossible to put workers first. When you read the evidence you've presented in the case, you realize that the standards the workers were pushing for are not unattainable standards. It was reasonable things, including something as simple as listen to the workers. When they tell you that I've had enough for the day, I cannot watch any more harmful content, don't force them to sit back on that chair to continue moderating work. It's something as simple as allowing only an hour of wellness counseling in a week for a moderator might not be adequate. And instead, you should adapt a model where it's responsive to the worker's needs. If this worker sees graphic content like 10 times in that week, they need to receive support 10 times. And that's going to be a budgetary decision, of course. But to put workers first means to swallow that cost. What we're seeing is a model that completely ignores the welfare of the worker, puts productivity and the metrics first, to the point where you're monitoring their bathroom breaks, you're monitoring their health breaks. So at what point does this person decompress from seeing the work? You're keeping them in this torture chamber where throughout they're exposed to harmful content. So there are things that could have been done that could have made the situation better. Yes, content moderation inherently is dangerous work, but traditionally there have been other forms of dangerous work. The solution is not to abolish the work. The solution has always been to put measures in place so that workers can work in a safer environment.
That was Kenyan lawyer Mercy Mutemi. The BBC has approached Meta for comment. It has not responded, but has previously responded to allegations of a poor working environment in Kenya by saying it requires partners to provide industry-leading conditions.
Rising temperatures,
the extreme weather,
melting ice,
they're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness, it is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And you're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now I've got George Conboy, Chairman of Brighton Securities, with me. Hello, George.
Hello, Deanna.
George, gold has hit new highs this week, a safe haven but for many. But, you know, George, this actually confuses me because investors, they flock to gold when times are uncertain, right? But, I mean, the inflation has come down, interest rates are coming down. So I thought people would be pretty happy with the economy at the moment.
You would think so, Deanna, but I think there are a few factors driving gold, and it is all-time high price, a little over $2,600 an ounce. Inflation fears remain despite the Fed's interest rate cut yesterday. You have big buyers in Asia, traditionally a big market for gold, where the Chinese economy is weakening and maybe there's a little safe haven there. And then instability with a few wars around the world, those things together are enough to push that price up. We don't think the increase is over.
U.S. markets had a bit of a roller coaster week after an initial boost from the Fed's rate cut. Things have cooled down. Why did that enthusiasm kind of fade so quickly?
Yeah, we think that, Deanna, the investors have expected for a couple of months now a rate cut from the Fed, 25 to 50 basis points. When it finally arrived, there was that brief burst of enthusiasm. But the fact is, it wasn't a surprise. And traders pulled back instantly. So unless there's a surprise, either upside or downside, we don't see much movement. And that's what happened this week.
And FedEx took a real beating. What's behind that one?
Soft economy. People don't want to pay up for express delivery, wait for free delivery. Happened to UPS as well this year. So we're seeing that across the board in the shipping markets as consumers kind of pull their horns in.
All right, George, stay there for a minute because we're going to talk about Boeing now, because that strike by Boeing production workers has already racked up over $500 million in losses. More than 30,000 employees are now in their second week of protesting, fighting against cuts to bonuses and pensions. They recently turned down an offer that included a pay rise as compensation. With no resolution in sight, Patrick Anderson, president of Anderson Economic Group, has crunched the numbers on this unfolding situation.
It's already cost Boeing and its workers $571 million in U.S. dollars. And a very large share of that is right in the state of Washington, in the northwest of the United States, where a large number of these vehicles or these planes are being built, and where a lot of Boeing employees and shareholders are. So it's expensive, and the number is going to go up in week two.
Yeah, so you expect for the long-term impact to be even worse.
I don't think we get to a long-term impact. A strike like this, if it's not contained within a certain amount of time, can destroy a company. And especially a company like Boeing, which along with Airbus is one of the two dominant producers of commercial airplanes. They also produce military aircraft. And these are really systems that people buy parts for and plan for not only years, but decades. So if they don't get back to work, like with any company, but it's particularly damaging for a maker of big complex systems like airplanes, to stay in business and be reliable.
Now, Boeing, it's announced furloughs for white-collar workers, and furloughs is this word where people are essentially just put on hold. Will steps like that reduce the company's losses, or is it just a stopgap, really?
The almost immediate action taken by Boeing management to cut costs, including furloughing white-collar workers, furloughing other workers just because they can't be productive while their machinists are on strike, is a sign of just how tight things are at Boeing. They've lost a lot of money. They're under tremendous pressure from their customers, from the government. So it's a sign of how serious this is, and one of the reasons why we see this as a very high-risk situation.
Well, how would you compare it with past strikes like the UAW walkouts?
We did, at Anderson Economic Group, the same kind of rigorous calculations. The UAW strike last year, which was against GM and Ford and Stellantis, was more expensive in the first week. It was $1.6 billion in the first week, which is a big number, but it's what you expect when a very large union goes after and effectively shuts down a good portion of three major manufacturers in the United States and in parts of Canada and Mexico. For this, $500 million is a lot of money in the first week. It's going to be more in week two, because right now the cost of suppliers have been relatively limited because we're assuming they're adjusting their inventory and production schedules. But you get to week two, week three, you can't adjust anymore and you have to start laying off workers.
And then there's also the ripple effects, right? I mean, how will the strike impact the local economy there?
Much as we saw in, say, the Detroit area, places that where the auto industry is so dominant, when you have the major employer go on strike, it affects not just factories, it affects restaurants, it affects dry cleaners, it affects clothing stores. It's definitely affecting Seattle, and basically it's going to start affecting them quite a bit more. And workers who don't consider themselves to be in the aerospace industry, but where almost all their customers are.
And then in the more macro, the aerospace industry in general, I mean, that could have ripple effects to even the price of somebody's airline ticket, couldn't it?
For most of the people flying the major commercial airlines over the next month, I don't see much of an effect. But if you go down the road, when you make it harder to reliably source these aircraft, it affects the price and the cost to customers.
But even if it bounces back, its reputation is damaged, isn't it? And it's not the only thing this year that Boeing has had to deal with.
It's definitely something where the reputation of Boeing has already taken some body blows because of safety issues. And if they don't get back to work and they don't get back to reliably producing components, it could hurt them quite a bit.
That was Patrick Anderson, president of Anderson Economic Group. And I've still got George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities, with me. George, I want the Wall Street angle on this. How has Boeing's share price fared this week?
Oh, the shares have done poorly, Leanna. They're down this week. They've been down really all year. Boeing's having a tough time with investors, and it's not just their stock price. If you look at Boeing's bonds in the market, people don't notice it as much. But the bonds aren't selling well. The prices are down. Fixed income investors concerned about a slightly higher risk of default, and that raises Boeing's borrowing cost both today and down the road.
Mm-hmm. George Conboy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on World Business Report.
Thanks.
Now, as we near the end of 2024 basketball season, there's been a lot of buzz around women's basketball in the US, especially in the WNBA. And this season has been a standout. There's been major growth in sponsorships, new broadcast deals, and a big jump in media attention and viewership. But here's the question. Is all this momentum helping the WNBA make money? Izzy Greenfield has been digging into these questions for Business Daily.
I play basketball, and my coach, he got tickets, and then Daddy bought them, and we went to a game, and then after that, I got really into it, and now this is my seventh game I'm going to.
That's 6-year-old Colvin Brittany, who can barely contain his excitement as he waits in the queue to watch his favourite WNBA team, the New York Liberty. And he's not the only one who's excited. C.H. Reynolds is also a huge basketball fan and says the league is like a family.
I feel like the NBA is built on stars in such a crazy way. And with the WNBA, it's built on teams. I mean, this is an unfortunate way to think about it, and I wish I didn't think this way, but we live in a capitalist society. It'll take off as long as there are stars who can help it take off. As long as the economics follow the popularity, I think the teams and the sport can grow.
The WNBA has experienced somewhat of a breakout year in the 2024 season, which runs from May to October. There's been success both on and off the court. Launched in 1996 as the women's counterpart to the NBA, the Professional Basketball League for Women is based in the United States. And this year, players like Breanna Stewart and rising superstar Caitlin Clark have captivated fans, and the league has seen record attendance and viewership numbers. On the sidelines, the WNBA has secured some landmark broadcast deals. New York City-based sports writer Erica Ayala says these deals are really important for the WNBA's status.
Prime has stepped up once again. They have an 11-year media rights deal, which includes Disney, so that's ABC, ESPN, and the whole Disney family, Amazon Prime, and NBC has come back into the fold. What we understand is that the WNBA is going to receive about $200 million a year in this 11-year deal. And the deal will begin in 2026. We're starting to see now that there's a little bit of more competition. You know, Prime really came in big time. And I think people are a little surprised that some of the bigger events are going to be on Amazon Prime, and the price of expansion has gone up for the WNBA, but people are coming up with that money. They are paying these new prices. And so, you know, there's a saying, a cultural saying here in the United States, yesterday's price is not today's price. And that is definitely what we're seeing in the WNBA.
The Men's Basketball League, the NBA, is one of the most profitable professional sports in the United States. It pulls in estimated $10 billion annually. And despite its popularity, the women's game still struggles with a smaller fan base compared to the men's, which limits things like ticket sales and merchandise revenue. In 2018, current NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said that the WNBA had lost an average of $10 million annually since it was founded. The Washington Post has reported that the league and its teams are expected to lose around $50 million in 2024. Back to Erica Ayala.
You know, that's a little bit of a tricky conversation. One, because of just what is and is not reported directly from the NBA and even from the WNBA and its teams. I guess the question that I have is, if you have the WNBA, a part of a larger umbrella organization, and that organization is touting that the WNBA loses them money, at what point is the larger umbrella organization going to take control of their business model to make that not the case?
That was Izzy Greenfield with that report. I'm dancing around in studio with all that music. You can hear more about the profitability of the WNBA on Business Daily. Just search for it wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it from World Business Report from the BBC World Service. You can get a podcast of this program. It's always available by searching for World Business Report wherever you listen to yours. Thanks to Josh Martin and Rachel Briggs, who are our producers today. And I'm Leanna Byrne. As ever, thank you so much for listening.
Rising temperatures,
the extreme weather,
melting ice.
They're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness. It is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.